The Tom Woods Show, episode 930.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If your homeschool program is making you crazy and running you ragged, don't wait till next term to fix it. Check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum right now. Plus, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you join through my link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here by myself today. I want to talk about something Bernie Sanders said not long ago. I guess I thought I wouldn't be saying those words anymore, but there he is, still talking, and here I am still talking. And in particular, if you're on my email list, you knew this episode was coming. I was griping about it the other day. He was making the observation that it's rather expensive to live in a lot of American cities these days, or it's difficult for people who earn the minimum wage to get by in the economy. And therefore, he draws the conclusion that we ought to pay them more. We ought to increase the minimum wage. And that solves the problem. So I thought I would talk about this a bit. This got raised in my private Facebook group, which you can access via supportinglisteners.com if you're interested. And somebody posted this, and a big discussion ensued with a lot of comments, intelligent comments, in response to Bernie's view. So I thought I would review a couple of those and then give my own thoughts about the matter. In particular, he's talking about housing and how hard it is to find housing that's affordable, particularly in certain cities. Now, these are cities, of course, where left liberals have been in charge for 50 years or more. And in some cases, they've been in charge to the point that nobody could even touch them. And the result is these places are unlivable for most people. I mean, just from a financial standpoint. And of course, there could be other reasons, you know, reasons other than taxes and regulations coming out of government that could make a place expensive to live in. But that's at least a factor. And it's interesting that Bernie, like a lot of people who agree with him, shows absolutely no curiosity whatsoever about what might be causing particular places to be expensive to live in. No curiosity about this whatsoever. This is just a given. And now we have to roll up our sleeves and come up with the redistribution approach that's going to fix this problem. But it is worth looking at why they might be expensive places to live in. I'm going to get to that a little bit later. Of course, at the same time, sometimes places are expensive to live. The reason behind it is that a lot of people want to live there. These are very attractive places, and people are outbidding each other to try to live there. I mean, after all, we can't all live along the California coast. So there is a bidding process that goes on the market that, in effect, distributes these properties. So it could well be that if you want to live in, let's say, the handful of most desirable places in the entire country, yeah, you are going to have a hard time doing that when you're fresh out of college, you have no experience, and you're earning not as much as you will earn someday. So yeah, to immediately demand that I must be able to live in places that where everybody in the world would envy me is a bit self-centered. I mean, there are other people in the world. After all, you are not the only person in the universe, which unfortunately is the way I think Bernie gets people to think. And my friend, I better not say his name because he didn't tell me I could, but he says, is he really saying that everybody, no matter how unskilled, is entitled to live in the wealthiest zip codes in the country? Good question. Don't people, by the way, share apartments? Don't we have roommates? Don't people have a roommate, two roommates, three roommates? And of course, in college, you know, we had, look at the square footage you lived in there, right? I mean, if I never lived in a dorm at Columbia because I was a grad student, but when I looked at the dorm rooms people lived in as undergraduates at Columbia College, it was unbelievable. I mean, you would open the door and the door would hit the bed as you were opening it. It was ridiculous, but they survived. But of course, you wouldn't be allowed to do that because of government regulations. Your apartment has to be, you know, or your living space has to be a certain size and whatever. Young people get by. Anyway, one of the folks in my group says something kind of like this. He says, what exactly is wrong with people sharing while they work their way up the job ladder? If not for all the housing regulations, you could have six to a small apartment, and since the burden of rent was so little, put money aside for training or a place to buy. Yeah, it'd be crowded, but no worse than people have lived through through most of history. Besides, they're at work 40 hours a week and in bed 56 hours. So we have that. And another person says, people can make any place desirable if they're willing to make something a priority and accept a few inconveniences. Maybe instead of desirable, he means plausible or a possibility for them. Can't afford to live in Seattle or San Francisco or New York? If living in one of those cities is the most important quality of life factor, acquire a skill that makes you more competitive for a high salary. Now, I have a few little things I want to say before I go on to some of the contributing factors to making housing more expensive in certain places. Of course, obviously, during the years of the housing bubble, we saw how Federal Reserve policy and government policy can push home prices up. That was obvious. And I explained the whole thing in my book Meltdown, which miraculously still to this day to me became a New York Times bestseller. Again, that's how you know the economy's bad, when people actually voluntarily shell out money for a book on the economy. So I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/930. You can also get the audiobook version for free via the Audible offer at tomwoodsaudio.com. So I've explained that a number of times. We've got a bunch of episodes on housing, and I'm not really in the mood to go over it again. Sometimes I remember my professor, Ernest May. I don't know if I told you this story or not, but he taught American foreign policy when I was an undergrad, and he had written a book on the Monroe Doctrine. And he came out and he said, you know, I am not going to be lecturing on the Monroe Doctrine. I wrote a book so that I would never, ever have to discuss this topic again. Read my book. That's all you need to know. So I'm not quite like that with housing, but getting there. Let's just say I'm getting there. But what I do recall distinctly is that when home prices fell in 2008, people acted like this. Well, not when I say people, I mean government officials, not normal people. Government officials acted as if this was the worst thing in the world. We've got to put a floor beneath housing prices. Housing prices are collapsing. This is terrible. We got to shore them up. Why exactly? Obviously, because they're thinking about people who have money poured into a house and they're seeing the value of the house fall. Right, but aren't these exactly the same people who tell us all day long about the need for affordable housing? You're getting it. That's how you get it. Prices fall. That is what affordable housing is. How can you have affordable housing without prices falling? Well, the way government people think about affordable housing is not cheap housing. That is never the consideration. Affordable housing, because if that were their consideration, they would have been happy that house prices were falling. Finally, young couples trying to get their start in the world can have a reasonable chance of being able to get a house. Isn't that great? No, it's the worst thing in the world. So I don't really believe they want affordable housing, because they got it and they treated it like the return of Godzilla. We absolutely cannot have that. So affordable housing to them means the house price stays high. We just get you low interest loans to stay in debt the rest of your life to pay it off, which is also the way they think of affordable education. We're not actually going to reduce the subsidies that wind up pushing up the price of education. We're going to do all kinds of things to subsidize education. And then when the price goes way up, we'll then, again, extend you low interest loans to be able to pay it off. That's what makes it affordable, that you can take out a loan. Not affordable in the sense in which a normal person means the word affordable, where you actually can afford the thing on your own. Second thing I want to say before talking about at least some of the factors causing this is that now rent control is becoming more popular again as a policy option. It's being discussed in a variety of places. And of course, you certainly see this being raised in places like Seattle. And I know there's that, a socialist city councilwoman. I can't remember what her name is, or even if that's her position, but she's been talking about rent control. So the idea is the price that you have to pay for an apartment, the rental price, is going up or is too high by their standards. They think it should be lower. Then their solution is simply to force it down. Let's just force it down. And there shouldn't be any problems associated with that. We'll just force it down through threats of violence, and then everybody will have everything they want. But I'll just say very quickly on rent control, certainly you could read, I'm pretty sure there's a chapter on it in Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. But the long and the short of it is, if you say that rental units can be rented for no more than some arbitrary amount, what are you actually doing? Of course, you're reducing the supply of housing, because if you're going to put a cap on what people can charge, then fewer people are going to go to the trouble of building housing. That's just that's a fact that you see repeated, or on display over and over and over again all over the place. Then secondly, it leads to very, very bad landlord-tenant relationships, because when you artificially reduce the supply through government policy, you get a long line of people waiting for housing. And therefore, landlords know that they don't have to really cater to tenants anymore, because there's a long, long line of them waiting out there. There are a lot more where these people came from. So if they don't like the fact that I haven't repaired this or fixed that other thing or answered their calls or dealt with the chipped paint or whatever, fine. I got a million other people who would be very, very happy to get this apartment at this rate. So pack your bags and go. These are just obvious consequences of rent control. Now, what Bernie thinks about, of course, is let's just pay people more, and that will help them to live in these different places. Now, I could at least understand the logic of that if his idea was we in the government should just send people checks, and these checks will supplement their incomes to make it possible for them to live wherever in the world it is they want to live, which, again, seems a little bit self-centered, that anybody anywhere ought to just be able to live in the most desirable parts of the country by some standards. Just immediately and automatically, they should just be entitled to this. That does seem, strike me anyway, as being a little bit self-centered. Don't other people matter? And don't they have a claim on these things? Why do you get to elbow your way in? Oh, but I'm not elbowing my way in, the Bernie supporter will say. I just want housing for everyone. Obviously, you don't, because if you're advocating rent control, you are actually reducing the amount of housing supply available. So obviously, you don't. So let's not pretend that this is just an egalitarian desire to get housing for everybody. It's a desire to get cheap housing for you, because that is the only thing that you could possibly hope for with rent control. You may wind up being one of the so-called lucky ones, where you live in a build, you do get one of the rent-controlled apartments while everybody else has nothing, and you wind up living under a miserable landlord because he has no incentive to be anything else. But anyway, my point is, I could at least understand the logic if Bernie said, these are expensive places to live, and therefore the government needs to supplement people's income. But when he thinks about this kind of issue, he doesn't think that way. Instead, he thinks, let's make the employer pay more. Now, what the employer has to do with any of this, I have no idea. The employer is the only person on earth who's making these people financially better off in the first place. And now the burden falls on them even further. It's not their fault that the city is expensive to live in. And even if it were, it was none of your business, right? I mean, they don't owe people an apartment, or they don't owe. All they're doing is making offers. You want to take my offer to work here? If not, that's okay. You can work somewhere else. But it's interesting that the burden would fall on the employer, as opposed to just saying, well, look, we want to help the poor, or we want to help struggling people. Let's just give them money. Instead, it's let's let employers give them money, because they have a lot of money. So let's make them pay it out. Just weird to me that you would think, I mean, unless you're just an outright commie, it's just weird that you would immediately think the employer is the person on whom this burden should fall, even though the employer is the only person who is actually doing anything to help the person. We're going to make this person's life, the employer, even more difficult and challenging, because it seems like that person must have a lot of money. Look, they operate out of a really big building. So when it comes to the minimum wage, again, I'm going to link to episodes I've done on the minimum wage. Really quickly, I'll say, when you are faced with these arguments that, oh, modern economic studies show that there are no problems associated with the minimum wage and employment, well, yes, it's true you can find methodological problems with those studies that are quite serious, but you're not going to be able to get into those really in an argument with your friends. So the major argument would be that the people who are calling for a $15 an hour minimum wage are in effect calling for an over 100% increase in the minimum wage. And there isn't one of those so-called studies that deals with anything like that substantial a hike in the minimum wage. So they're not really able to bring forth anything that suggests that there won't be employment effects from that steep of a rise. And of course, they even slightly acknowledge this by the fact that they gradually increase the minimum wage from the present amount up to $15. You know, they make it go up $10 one year and $11.50 the next and whatever. But of course, if it's as great as they say it is, why would it not be raised all at once? So there you go there. So the minimum wage is a lot of stuff to say, and I've said a lot about it myself. So I'll link to minimum wage stuff at tomwoods.com/930. So, all right, so now I want to look at some other factors here. And Thomas Sowell, who wrote a book called The Housing Boom and Bust, and then that came out in a, I think that came out in, if I'm remembering this right, and I'm probably not, actually, I don't remember the exact date that that came out, but I think he updated it later, and he did cite my book Meltdown in it, so that was nice. But Sowell points out a number of the factors contributing toward lowering the supply. I mean, the government policy and the Federal Reserve can increase the demand for housing by flooding the economy with credit and then giving special consideration to money that goes into housing. You know, that is to say, you can very, very easily get that money. You don't have to provide documentation. You don't have to provide traditional down payments, whatever. There are all kinds of loosening of standards that goes on that leads to more demand for housing. But what Sowell is pointing out is that it's not just that the demand for housing increases, also that the supply decreases simultaneously. And of course, both of those factors in isolation would indeed raise housing prices. And when they're both taken together, well, they raise housing prices all the more. And he asks this, was it just a big coincidence that housing prices in coastal California began skyrocketing in the 1970s when building bans spread like wildfire under the banner of open space, saving farmland, or whatever other slogans would impress the gullible? And he says, when more than half the land in San Mateo County is legally off limits to building, how surprised should we be that housing prices in the city of San Mateo are now so high that politically appointed task forces have to be formed to solve the, quote, complex question of how things got to be the way they are and what to do about it? And he says, however simple the answer, it will not be easy to go against the organized, self-righteous activists for whom open space is a sacred cause, automatically overriding the interests of everybody else. So there's one factor at work that is restricting the supply of housing, potentially. So then secondly, let's develop this further. I want to cite here a statement by Ben Powell, who's been a guest on the show, who's written a lot about housing and who made a statement before, I don't remember which governmental body, might have been in D.C. for all I know, and I haven't got it right in front of me, but I do have the passage that I like. He's saying this to government officials. He says, economists have found that the leading causes of high housing prices in the nation's least affordable markets are government regulations and restrictions that prevent or slow the expansion and renewal of local housing supply. And then he tries to explain basic economics to them. He says, housing prices of both new and existing homes are determined by the total supply of homes in relation to the demand for them. In most markets, increases in demand are met with an increasing quantity supplied. Unfortunately, the supply side of the market has been restricted by government regulations, and he talks about them. He says, many economists who have found that government restrictions on building cause the housing affordability problem are not ideologues or advocates of any interest group. It has been found by economists at top universities and published in the leading peer-reviewed scholarly journals. So then he cites Harvard and Wharton economists working together who studied the relationship between land use regulation and housing prices, and they found that where land was relatively unregulated, homes were priced at close to construction costs. But in regulated areas, homes cost much more than the cost of construction. And the two economists estimated that 90% of the difference between the physical construction cost of a new home and its market price was caused by government land use regulation. And only 10% of the difference was due to intrinsically scarce land. Then he cites a couple of Berkeley professors who did a study on California, published in the American Economic Review, which is the top-rated journal in economics. And he says they find a positive relationship between the degree of regulatory stringency and housing prices, and that new housing construction is lower in more regulated cities. And as a result, housing prices grow fastest in more regulated cities. So isn't that kind of interesting? I mean, at least interesting. If you have any intellectual curiosity whatsoever about how the world works, wouldn't you want to know that? And yet no thought about this at all. None whatsoever. What could be causing this? What could be causing this? No interest in looking into any factors that could be causing it. In a way, it reminds me of Paul Krugman's response to the 2008 financial crisis. He kept saying, "I am so sick and tired of people talking to me about what got us into this mess when the important thing is how to get us out," as if you could get us out without knowing what got us in, or as if you could really be super concerned about getting us out and yet have zero curiosity about what got us in. Just weird. I just don't understand people who think this way. Well, I found an article from maybe a year or two ago about Seattle in particular, because Seattle was singled out by Bernie Sanders in his comments. And apparently there was some talk, even among the mainstream folks, about doing away with single-family zoning in Seattle. Now, I'm going to do an episode on zoning. I realize I have not done an episode on zoning up to now. So we're going to do that probably in the coming week or so. So we'll get into more about what zoning is, and we'll look at how, in a stateless way, you could replicate the good things that people... I mean, there is a reason zoning exists. It's not entirely to oppress people. There are concerns that people have. How could you handle those on a completely free market? And you easily could handle them. So we're going to talk about that with somebody who's written a lot about it. So that'll be coming up very soon. But anyway, the draft report said approximately 65% of Seattle's land, not just its residential land, but all its land, is zoned single family, severely constraining how much the city can increase housing supply. So they acknowledge that it's government regulation that causes some of these problems. And that, so that's encouraging that some people are, at least, you know, unlike Sanders, they're actually interested in looking at these sort of questions. Well, anyway, what I found interesting about this article was the comment by Irene Wall, co-chair of the City Neighborhood Council's Land Use Committee. And she thought the whole thing was a dumb idea. She says, "I hope the whole idea goes away. It's a dumb idea that will shatter the golden goose that has fed Seattle's tax system so long with rising property values, and it's not going to get us social justice." Amazing. Just goes to show how utterly clueless these people are. Here's a thing that you can clearly see would make housing prices fall and make them more affordable. And now the complaint is, but if housing prices fall, then, you know, we won't be able to get as much in property taxes? Is that her thinking? That if with rising property values, we've been able to get a lot out of people. Now, probably the sheer supply of new housing would swamp any depressing effect on prices anyway, in terms of there'd be more taxpayers now paying property tax. I mean, who even knows? But the very fact that instead of saying, "Hey, here's a great new way to make housing more affordable," it's, no, if housing becomes more affordable, then people will be paying lower property taxes correspondingly. Wow, they really don't care about people. they really do not. Then we have inclusionary zoning ordinances, which, depending on what jurisdiction you're talking about, require builders to set aside some portion of a new development to be sold at to be sold to people at below market rates, people, low income people, moderate income people. And so maybe it could be 10, 15, 20, 25% of the homes have to be set aside for this purpose. And you sometimes will hear, like in California, there are some pressure groups that say, "We have in this way provided quality, affordable housing to over 80,000 Californians." And this is tremendous because we basically just force the builders to build affordable housing. Well, again, Ben Powell says, well, how about we talk about economics? If you place price controls on a percentage of new homes, you're going to lower builders' profits, which means you're basically taxing these new homes. And as we know with any tax, like a carbon tax means less carbon. Or a tax on some undesirable behavior means less of that behavior. So a tax on building homes, what do you think that leads to? So you reduce the supply of homes, and you raise the price of the non-inclusionary units and the existing stock of housing. So it turns out that Ben and Ed Stringham, who's also been on the show, studied the effect of inclusionary zoning in California when they both taught out in California, and they found that taxing new housing makes the vast majority of housing less affordable. They found that in the Bay Area, cities that had inclusionary zoning ordinances imposed what was in effect a tax of $44,000 on every new home. Think that might have an effect on something? In L.A. and Orange counties, they found the effective inclusionary tax was $66,000 per new home. They found that it also decreased the supply of new housing. They found that housing production on average decreased more than 30% in the first year in Bay Area cities. They found that in L.A. and Orange counties, housing production decreased 61% over a seven-year period following the adoption of the zoning mandates. Now, there, you know, who knows, right? Who knows all the different factors that could have gone into this? But certainly, if it had been reversed, the other side would be cheering and pointing to this and accusing you of being anti-science if you're not in favor of inclusionary zoning. So anyway, there's another factor. So there's a lot of stuff going on here, stuff that could be fixed immediately. And of course, when they point to the affordable housing they've produced, it's a tiny sliver when compared to all the housing that doesn't get built or the rises in price for all the remaining houses. It's nothing. It's a big nothing burger, as they say, but they just hope nobody knows the real numbers. They just hear, hey, we made housing more affordable for 12 people, and they don't think about the, you know, 100,000 who have had their lives made much, much worse through all this. So, I don't know. I think if you're curious about this stuff, you'd want to know about this instead of just scratching your head and saying, well, it's probably capitalism somehow that leads to this problem. So anyway, I'll have some stuff up on the show notes page that will be of interest to you. TomWoods.com/930. Hope you're going to be joining me in Orlando, by the way, on September 9th for my 1,000th episode extravaganza with MC Eric July and special guest Michael Malice and Tom DiLorenzo. How can you not, especially when it costs you nothing? It is free and open to the public. I simply ask that you register over at TomWoods.com/Orlando, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.